I'm Nish Weiseth.
I'm Amy Sullivan, and this is Impolite Company, a show where we talk about the tricky subjects polite people are supposed to avoid, especially religion and politics. This week, we're taking a close look at the variety of evangelical responses to Alabama Senate candidate Roy Moore, after accusations surfaced that he sexually preyed upon teenage girls, in at least two cases allegedly committed sexual assault, when he was in his 30s. We'll also discuss the shift in how white evangelicals view the morality of politicians.
We'll also be asking the question, what in the hell is happening at Liberty University? To give us some insight, we'll talk to Pastor Jonathan Martin, who was recently singled out and banned from the university's campus after trying to organize a protest in response to Jerry Falwell's cozying up to Steve Bannon. Before we get to our main stories of the week, we always start with each of us taking a quick hit on a story that we've been following. Amy, what grabs your attention this week that does not have to do with Roy Moore?
Not much this week. So I'm going to bring up a story that kind of got lost in all of the news that came down the pike last week, which is the fact that Notre Dame has decided, reversing its position of the last few years, to go ahead and actually offer contraception coverage to its employees and students on campus.
I saw that.
Yeah, so crazy. That is a change. Notre Dame was one of a handful of religious groups that had sued the government during the Obama administration over the birth control mandate in the Affordable Care Act. They had cited moral objections to the alternatives that were provided by the Obama folks. And now they say that, surprise, there is a workaround that will allow them to offer the coverage while not actually paying for the contraception in their plan, which sounds like it makes sense, except that that is exactly the workaround that the Obama Health and Human Services came up with. You know, this is for a much longer conversation that we don't have time for today, but I have lots of thoughts and criticisms of both sides about how the mandate was handled and how the exemptions were crafted. I think the Obama White House really muffed it up at the beginning.
Absolutely.
But this whole thing was also handled in very bad faith. And the pun is, if not intended, at least accurate there, by a lot of Catholic groups that use this as an opportunity to beat up on the administration about religious freedom and kind of make this another data point in the liberals, you know, are a existential threat to religious liberty argument.
Right.
I read this thinking, well, you know, number one, good for Notre Dame. I'm glad that they did this. But two, they're still doing this in bad faith because they're pretending that this is something new that has happened under Trump's presidency that has now made it possible for them to reconcile their moral objections with the concern and the ask, basically, by their staff and students to be able to access contraception through the health plan. You know, there are so many points we can make about this issue, including the fact that a lot of the employers who have made a big deal out of this previously had health plans that covered contraception, and they never made a peep out of it. It was only when there was a federal mandate that said that they had to. And I understand for religious freedom purists that there is a difference between voluntarily offering a plan to your employees and having the state tell you
right
that you have to cover it. But in this case, you know, folks like Hobby Lobby had previously been providing birth control coverage to their employees. They apparently now still invest in plans that include the makers of contraception for their employees' retirement plans. So there's a lot of bad faith going on. And what I worry is that Notre Dame's reversal on this is going to teach Democrats a very bad lesson about working with Catholics in the future, or specifically not working with Catholics. There is a lot of hurt feeling on both sides, particularly among Democrats who work in congressional offices and who had worked for the Obama administration, who are themselves Catholics or lapsed Catholics, and who kind of had the takeaway from this whole debate that you can't trust Catholic groups and the Catholic bishops when you're working with policy procedures with them. And this would seem evidence to prove that they are right, that in fact, institution like Notre Dame never had any intention of working with them, but that the workarounds that they had developed were perfectly appropriate. And it was just because they were offered by a Democratic administration that Catholic institutions refused to accept them and continued to insist that they were, you know, working at cross purposes with religious liberty. And that really worries me more than just this one case, because there are so many issues in which the Catholic Church and Catholic institutions are on the same page with Democrats. And for the two to decide that they can't work together would be really damaging for our politics and for actually getting things done when it comes to public policy.
Right. I mean, I just think about immigration as one. I mean, that's a huge one that all aspects of
immigration, healthcare.
Yeah, you name it.
Going forward, I mean, the bishops were very much opposed to repealing Obamacare and really hated the alternatives that Republicans had put forward.
Yeah, they came out hot against it for sure. Huh, that's interesting. Well, I guess we'll see what happens. What has been the, like, kind of layperson's Catholic response to this? Have you heard anything about that? Like, what's...
You know, there was so much going on last week that it really yeah. felt like this disappeared as soon as it got reported. So that's one reason I wanted to highlight it is I want to make sure that it doesn't completely disappear, because I do think that it's important.
Yeah, it is important.
But we'll continue to follow it.
Yeah, thanks for sharing.
Nish, what have you been paying attention to this week?
The thing that I've been paying attention to is a series at Think Progress, written by Jack Jenkins, on the leaders of the quote-unquote religious left, which I was so happy to see this because there are really phenomenal leaders and voices that are happening and are emerging and who have actually been a part of some of these justice initiatives and policy initiatives for a long time on the religious left that get drowned out by all the talk about evangelicals. And I'm going to go ahead and apologize in advance because we are going to perpetuate that problem today by talking about the disaster that is American evangelicalism.
But there's so much going on.
I know. Like, I really wish that American evangelicalism was less of a goddamn disaster so that we could talk about other things, but they're just dominating the news cycle for all of the wrong reasons. So this was...
Well, and I'm glad you said that, because just to point out for our listeners, we really did have the intention, and we do going forward, of covering the entire religious landscape.
Oh my gosh.
Not just about white evangelicals and about Catholics, but about Buddhists and Hindus and Jews and Muslims and everybody. But it just happens that this is a moment in history when white evangelicalism is just going over a cliff and we have to document it.
We have to talk about how terrible they are. It's just, unfortunate. Anyway, so this series on Think Progress, written by Jack, has been really great. It's been really refreshing to see, oh, here are these leading voices talking about some of these big issues. Currently, he has three people that he's highlighted. The first person is Sister Simone Campbell, and that name may be familiar to some of you. She's a Catholic nun, an advocate of Obamacare, and she helped push it through Congress. And she's a lawyer, an advocate, and she's one of the founders of Nuns on the Bus.
Nuns on the Bus.
Nuns on the Bus. And
she's appeared at the last two Democratic conventions, actually.
She has. She has spoken or prayed. Mm-hmm. One of the two. I can't remember. Yeah,
both.
Yes, she has been at both, and just a phenomenal, phenomenal voice. Has gotten pushback even from the Vatican when they came down hard on some of the nuns being active in the healthcare policy debate. So Jack highlighted her. He recently highlighted Reverend Angel Kyoto Williams, who is a Black queer Buddhist leader and activist, which was a fascinating perspective and a wonderful profile on her. And his most recent one is on Reverend Tracy Blackman, who you and I are aware of. She's a really fiery preacher and a leading spiritual voice in the Black Lives Matter movement. And she came out very forcefully against both the House and Senate Obamacare repeal bills. There was a video of her that went viral, at least on Twitter, of her standing in front of Mitch McConnell's office and preaching a hell of a sermon.
She is a voice.
She is incredible. And so I love this series. I love that Jack is taking the time to profile some of these voices because they are doing phenomenal work on issues of racial justice and healthcare and immigration and, I mean, a whole host of policy issues. There are people within the context of the American religious landscape that are doing really, really important work and doing a lot of grassroots organizing within their own faith traditions. That's super important to note, especially when white conservative evangelicals are dominating the news cycle for all of the wrong reasons. It feels really refreshing to see religious leaders be highlighted for some really good reasons. So I've been paying attention to that. I'm really excited to see who else he's going to highlight. I'm sure he's got a handful of folks that are just wonderful to hear from. So that's something I'm paying attention to. It's really, really lovely. Really lovely.
And it's a nice positive story too, to have the reminder that American religion is so interesting and diverse and has so much going on in lots of corners of the country. And we don't hear those stories often enough, but it's worth making the extra effort to read about them and learn about them.
Yeah, absolutely. So good.
But for right now, as you said, we're going to make the problem worse.
Sorry, America.
Let's dive into our first main story. Last week, as we said, Roy Moore, who's the Alabama candidate for Senate, was accused of sexually preying on teenage girls when he was in his 30s. And as you and I were discussing earlier, Nish, it's not just a matter of, is it okay for a man in his 30s to date teenagers? In several of these cases, what he has been accused of is a crime. First is no, but second, these are sexual assaults that people have described in several instances. And that has gotten lost in kind of the general nonsense about whether these age differences are appropriate among white evangelicals. Just this week, Beverly Young Nelson came forward and accused Moore of sexually assaulting her when she was 16. She is now the fifth woman, and that makes also five diehard Republican Trump voters. These are not Democratic stooges, who has come forward and spoken out against the candidate and former judge.
And it seems like the response to these sort of allegations, sexually preying upon and assaulting teenagers, would elicit a swift, harsh, and condemning response from literally every corner, both political and religious. But never underestimate the moral ambiguity of white conservative evangelicals when it comes to speaking out against someone who has given more power to their cause. Both Jerry Falwell Jr., who is the president of Liberty University and an avid supporter of Donald Trump, offered his support to Moore. And Franklin Graham said that he was praying for Moore and his family instead of, oh, I don't know, maybe praying for the women who have...
The women!
This is some grade A bullshit. Like, I get so irate. And I want to be really clear. Really, really clear about something when it comes to Roy Moore and the backlash that's happening now. This is a candidate for the U.S. Senate that was homophobic and said that homosexuality should be illegal. And this is a candidate who said that Keith Ellison, Congressman Keith Ellison, should be ineligible to serve in Congress because he's a Muslim. The fact that it was preying on and assaulting teenage girls that finally did it is disgusting. And the Republican Party and any person of faith who supported him at any point should be ashamed of themselves. It is abhorrent, Amy. And I am so angry. I'm so angry that this is the bar, like that the bar had to drop this low. And I feel like every single time with some of these guys, we keep lowering and lowering and lowering the bar, which makes all of their other things that they should have never been qualified to be a Senate candidate, like all of those other things, the saying that like homosexuality should be illegal and Keith Ellison should be ineligible to serve, like those should have disqualified Roy Moore to serve in the U.S. Senate from the beginning.
Never mind the fact that he had to leave his judgeship twice for breaking the law.
Twice! And the fact that this, the fact that he preyed on teenage girls, sexually assaulted teenage girls, that these allegations are the things that brought him down, pisses me right off. Oh my gosh, Amy, it makes me so mad. I'm going to need you to take over because it makes me horrifically mad.
I am right there with you. I think often, especially in the last couple of years, my response to just absurdity from white conservative evangelicals has been kind of an eye rolling or even sometimes trying to laugh it off as kind of a coping mechanism. But I am just angry about this.
I'm pissed.
And you're right. It is both that he was completely unqualified or should have been disqualified before any of this came out. But then, as we say, we get these accusations and that should be an instant just, okay, that's it, out. And yet, that was not the response of so many religious and political leaders. And we should say it's not across the board, at least in the evangelical community. And we'll get a little more into what are some defining characteristics of people who have been much quicker to speak out. I want to read to you what Jerry Falwell's initial response was. It comes down to a question of who is more credible in the eyes of the voters, the candidate or the accuser. That was his response. And I cannot tell you how angry that makes me and how I feel so much for all of the women in so many churches who have been hurt, who have been abused by somebody in a power of authority, a position of authority, and not been believed or have been told to shut up and be quiet about it. You know, it was bad enough when all of these guys last fall, when the Access Hollywood tapes came out, just gave Trump their cover and excused it with the argument that, well, we're not electing a pope.
And it was just locker room talk.
When it came out last fall, that was basically what Jerry Falwell said. He said, you know, what he said is not defensible, but we're all sinners, every one of us. We're not going to have a perfect candidate unless Jesus Christ is on the ballot. So basically, he was acknowledging, okay, this might have happened, but it really shouldn't matter to evangelicals when they're deciding who to vote for. With Roy Moore, the difference is he's saying, yeah, it turns out we actually don't believe you.
Right.
It all comes down to we don't believe women. And don't believe them that it happened, but also if it did happen, we don't believe you that it was actually a problem, that it was actually painful and hurtful and has haunted you your whole life. Because we are determining that it's not actually that big a deal.
Right. Because men, particularly white men, are always the determiners of what is true and not true. Right? No one else gets a say. Especially in church circles.
This just makes me want to burn it all down. Burn it all and start over with women. Women in charge.
There are so many things that we can unpack here. And one of the things that I've just been kind of exploring in my head a little that I would want your take on is talking about the inherent patriarchal structure that is in evangelical theology and in evangelical churches where women can't be pastors. Women can't be elders. Women can't be in positions of authority. Now, I'm not saying that women, just because you're a woman, you're automatically going to believe the accused. Like, we know that's not true. We know women who have also told other women, which feels like a very particular twist of the knife, to be quiet and, oh, it's no big deal. He's just a little handsy. You know, like, you know, giving all of these sort of covers to serial harassers and assaulters. But by not allowing women to be in positions of authority and to be in positions of pastoral care over women who are assaulted and harassed in church communities, and not just in church communities, this happens in businesses, in corporations, all different religious communities in the halls of politics. I mean, it is happening everywhere. And we're seeing that now as more and more women are coming forward talking about sexual assault and harassment. But particularly in the church, by not allowing women to be in positions of authority, we are potentially perpetuating the enabling power of men to provide cover for one another. And we're not creating spaces that are safe for women to come forward with their stories about sexual assault and harassment. And that's a problem. Like, that is an inherent problem that I think we have to address.
There are so many places where women's voices are silenced.
Yes. And the white evangelical church is one of them.
If you're not allowed to speak.
Yeah. And we have to, not only for the sake of victims of sexual assault and harassment, but for a whole host of other women who have been silenced for whatever different, you know, I mean, thousands of different reasons. Obviously, victims of harassment and assault should be first in line. But women have been silenced for, you know, hundreds of different reasons in the church. And it's time to start evaluating what are the systems that we have in place that perpetuate that problem. And I really do believe that it's those patriarchal structures and putting men only in places of authority that are creating some of these problems and making them worse. And we have to start talking about that stuff too. But I don't know, it has been heartening to also see some folks in the evangelical community and in the political realm come out in very, very vocal support of the victims straight out of the gate. I think of Mitt Romney, who came out, you know, and said, I believe the women, like, I believe them. He needs to step aside. He's disqualified, or however he phrased it. John McCain came out really strongly. Russell Moore, who's the president of the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission for the Southern Baptist Convention.
And Russell Moore, we want to stress, no relation to Roy Moore. But yeah, he had a tweet, whether in the hills of Hollywood or the halls of power, it doesn't matter. This is true. Sexual assault and child molestation are evil, unjust, satanic. I mean, that is as strong as it can get. And it's been good to see, but I have been so grateful for some of the women in white evangelicalism who have just had it. You know, we have talked about Beth Moore before, also no relation to Roy Moore.
No relation.
And no relation
too many
to
Moores.
Too
many Moores in white evangelicalism. We need to figure this out.
So she, last fall, after the Access Hollywood tape came out and after we heard some evangelical leaders start to explain it away, referred kind of elliptically to the fact that she had experience with being assaulted, and brooks no excuse for it. She has been really on fire this week, tweeting about it. I noticed just this morning, Lynn Hybels from Willow Creek, who we both know, had a statement out, and she usually, you know, tries to stay at least some arm's distance from a lot of political stuff. But even without naming Roy Moore directly, her statement calls out, quote, the distortions of twisted religion, misused power, and entrenched in evil patriarchal systems with the loving and liberating way of Jesus, which I think we can read as directly related to the Roy Moore situation. And what really I just wanted to throw out, because I found this most surprising and interesting, what really caught my attention was the Twitter activity of Kay Warren, who is Rick Warren's wife, and who is a leader in her own right, has been very active on issues from AIDS in Africa to sexual trafficking and
mental health since her son died.
Exactly.
Has been a big
yes.
One.
Mm-hmm. And she is usually pretty restrained on Twitter. I have noticed her kind of subtly stepping out over the last year, retweeting some criticisms of Trump occasionally. And the past week, she has been retweeting a lot other white conservative evangelicals who have been going after the idea that there's any justification for supporting Roy Moore. And I think it's relevant. She has written and spoken before about the experience of being molested by a staffer in her family's church when she was a child. And, you know, this is just a really important and personal issue for a lot of women. And I am interested to see how far this will push some women into kind of taking the reins and saying,
"That's right,
enough out of you. This is not the witness that we need. It is not the way to protect and speak to women in the church. And enough. Enough. It's our turn.
I'm ready. I don't know about you, but I am ready. I am ready.
More than ready.
To see a change. I'm ready to see a change. And I'm ready to see more. I mean, frankly, I'm also ready to see more men just step up and be brave and say, I believe the women. I mean, it took Mitch McConnell how many days? 4 or 5 days to finally come around and say, yeah, I believe the women, right? Which is a big deal.
And as much because he hates Steve Bannon as because
right.
he actually thinks it's the right thing.
That's exactly right. Now, Mitch McConnell is a integral figure in this particular instance, because if Roy Moore does continue on with his campaign and gets elected, Mitch McConnell being the majority leader can kind of lead the cause and make movements toward unseating him in the Senate. But it was only just today that Paul Ryan, with all of his moral integrity and
steel spine,
just, oh my gosh. How long did it take Paul Ryan to come out and say something? He came out finally this morning, and this is Tuesday morning when we're recording this, finally came out this morning and said, yeah, he should step aside. Really? It took you that long?
Heck of a conscience there, Paul.
Jeez. I mean, how long does it have to take you to realize that, hey, it's a good idea to stand with potential victims of sexual assault and harassment? Like, this is not a hard equation.
I think it's how many pulls does it take?
That's exactly.
How many pulls do you
bingo,
have to see?
Bingo. That's what it is. Is that as soon as Paul Ryan realized that it was going to be politically expedient for him to stand on the side of the victims is when he decided to come out and say something. And you know what? I have zero patience for that bullshit. That I'm like done. I am done with Paul Ryan. That guy has... Oh, he makes me so mad. And you know what? He won't do anything if it will even remotely damage his chances of passing this tax reform bill, which we could do a whole episode on the morality of the new tax reform bill. But we're not going to do that today. But I think that's what's making me mad about the politicians. Now, church leaders, I've got a whole sermon for them. But politicians... Everything is rooted in whether or not it's politically expedient for your agenda. And at what point do voters say, no, that's not how we work. That's not how we operate. That's not what's important. What's important are the lives and integrity of the victims of sexual assault and harassment, not your tax reform bill. Ugh! Makes me so mad. Makes me so mad. I'm so sick of these guys.
So, Nish, I have a question for you.
Yeah.
Exactly how loud did you scream when the Alabama state auditor said it wouldn't be a problem if Moore had been with a teenager because, hey, Mary and Joseph were a teenage and grown man couple, even though, is that biblical? No, that is not in the Bible. But also... Oh,
you mean you didn't hear me all the way in Chicago?
I couldn't hear you over my own screams, I think, is the problem.
Yes, I had a, I think, almost like primal. It was like, it was this primal howl of absolute disgust and despair. Whew, I get so, so mad at these people who want to retrofit their shitty theology to make this situation okay. There is nothing okay.
For partisan gain.
For partisan gain. For the...
That's what this is for.
The forward movement of your political agenda. You're going to throw these women who were teenage girls, who were children at the time, under the bus? Screw you, dude. That's what I have to say. And this brings us to these guys like Jerry Falwell and Franklin Graham, who I know they get a lot of airtime. And I know that we talk about them. And I hear the criticisms of you shouldn't talk about them because it perpetuates the problem. But here's the reality. Jerry Falwell Jr. is the president of a major Christian university where there are students who are studying and who are their families and themselves are giving them their dollars and to receive an education. And there are all these people that are under the influence of this one man. And it's a big deal. And I don't want to minimize it, how big of a deal it is when someone like Jerry Falwell, with his stature and his personal relationship to the president, says shit like this. Like, we have to talk about it. We have to talk about it because it's not okay when these men with all of this influence throw women under the bus when it comes to, I mean, anything, but specifically sexual assault and harassment. And so I don't know if there's anything that you have to say about it, but it makes me piss.
Well, just realistically, Franklin Graham and Jerry Falwell Jr. come from basically evangelical royalty.
It's, yes.
You know, the closest we have. Their dads helped define white evangelicalism in the 20th century.
Yep.
Like that is American history. And it matters what they do with the legacy and the power of those family names. And both of them, and we'll turn our fire on Franklin Graham some other week. I don't have time for him today, but both of them, I think, have more than squandered the opportunities that they could have had and that, you know, frankly, other members of their families have used with the high profile that they get and the automatic credibility that they have in a lot of evangelical circles. And both of them are just running their father's legacies straight into hell. We mean that literally. We say things like that. These guys just are doing such damage to Christian witness. And I feel a responsibility to call them out because it's not that they are hypocritical. I think that's a mistake people make very often is criticizing white evangelicals for what they see as behavior and comments that should be contrary to what they believe. What they have done is construct an entirely separate kind of theology to, as you say, to mesh with and be compatible with partisan ideals. And I think the only way to take that on is to take it on from an authentically Christian standpoint that can say, like, this is not Christian witness. And I used to hesitate about doing this because you and I have both experienced this. We know so many people who have been hurt by being told that we are not actually evangelicals. We cannot call ourselves evangelicals. And it hurts to have somebody else think they are in the position of judging your faith. And in many cases, going even further and saying, you know, I don't actually think you're saved. I don't think you can call yourself a Christian. And so I, with great wariness, approach doing that to anybody else. But I do think that these guys are misrepresenting Christianity and that has real serious and dramatic implications for millions of other conservative evangelicals. And we have to raise up other voices, and we have to be willing to confront head on just the heretical ideas that they have developed.
Yeah. I mean, at what point does the church stand up to some of this stuff and say a theology that is built on the foundation of partisan politics and not on the wholeness of the gospel? At what point do we say that type of theology is false? What's the point? Like, what's the breaking point? What's it going to take for the tide to turn on some of this stuff? Because anything that's built on something other than, you know, the wholeness of what we know as the gospel as Christians is inherently not, like, not true. It's not lasting. It's not Christianity, right? Like, it's just not Christianity. Like, we can call it a whole bunch of things without being ugly, but it's not Christianity. And so at what point do people finally just start calling it for what it is? That's what I want to know. And I think we're slowly starting to see folks call it for what it is. I think of Beth Moore, you know, I think of Russell Moore, I think of, you know, folks who are in the more conservative evangelical camp finally standing up and saying, like, guys, this is not the gospel that we know and that we are hoping to spread and that we are hoping to advocate for. This is just not the gospel. This is not the way of Christ. And we can have conversations about all the different methods and ways in which one can follow Jesus. That's one of the, that's why we have so many denominations. But the bottom line is, a theology built on partisan politics is not Christianity. And so I hope that as this stuff gets exposed and that more and more of these leaders align themselves with these sort of political ideologies rather than the way of Jesus, we start seeing more leaders come out and say it and just call it for what it is.
Well, one who's been willing to do it is Jonathan Martin, who you have had a really interesting conversation with. He's a pastor, an author, an activist, and he was recently kicked off Liberty's campus for organizing a protest. It was after Jerry Falwell Jr. aligned himself with former Trump political strategist and alt-right leader Steve Bannon to purge lukewarm Republicans from the party.
Yep. I talked with Jonathan a bit about his experience on the Liberty campus and his subsequent ban from the campus. But more importantly, I talked with Jonathan about some of the movement that's been happening with leaders like Falwell and why he thinks this sort of political alignment and aligning, you know, or having their theology built on a partisan politics is big trouble for Christianity in America. Jonathan Martin is a preacher and author based out of Tulsa, Oklahoma. When it became public that Jerry Falwell Jr. had aligned himself with former Trump political strategist and alt-right leader Steve Bannon, Jonathan decided to arrange a time of what he called prayerful resistance. It was planned to be an organic, peaceful gathering on the Liberty campus. He arrived on October 30th to see the band Johnny Swim perform, a musical act with whom he had a good personal friendship. While hanging out in the green room, Jonathan was met by 5 armed campus police officers who were to take his photo, escort him off the campus, and hand him a notice that he had been banned from the campus for life. Liberty later released a statement saying that they asked Jonathan to leave because of security concerns for the student body and that the prayer gathering required a permit. There were a couple of personal digs toward Jonathan in the statement as well, indicating that perhaps this wasn't entirely about security after all. Jonathan is a personal friend of mine, and I had the chance to catch up with him over Skype while he joins musical artist Nicole Nordeman and pastor and New York Times bestselling author Jen Hatmaker on their Moxie Matters tour. I talked with him not about his experience getting banned from campus, but about the movement of white conservative evangelicalism, the role of leaders like Jerry Falwell Jr., and what is giving him hope in the midst of all the pandemonium.
Hey, Nish, how you doing?
I'm good. How are you, buddy? Okay, well, I'm not going to waste your time, so let me go ahead and ask you.
Yeah.
So, Amy and I talked a little bit about your situation and everything that's happening with Jerry Falwell and everything else. And our question that we're asking is, what the hell is going on at Liberty University?
Yes, that's a great question. And isn't it? And it's a great question, yet isn't it a subset of a larger question, like what the hell is going on in the evangelical church? What the hell is going on in America, et cetera, et cetera?
You bet. You bet. So so my question for you is, what kind of damage do you think this sort of thing is doing to Christianity in America? Because to put it in more secular terms, it's it's a massive PR nightmare. But to put it in theological terms, it's doing damage to Christian witness.
Yes.
So how does the church recover from this in your mind? What is something that the church, that Christians can be doing to, I don't want to say combat what Jerry Falwell is coming out with, but to really provide a counter perspective and to help voters see, particularly Christian voters, that this is not the way of Jesus. What are your thoughts there?
Well, I have a lot of thoughts. I mean, to the first part of your question in terms of what is it doing? I feel like right now we're in a time where there's so much extreme rhetoric, you know, that I don't want to just be part of that noise, and I don't feel like I am in hysterics or whatever, but I truly think, like, I think the damage is incalculable. Like, I think we have no idea, like, no, I think we're not even close to being able to assess how much damage we're doing to the witness of the church in North America. Like, I don't think we're even at the beginnings of being able to assess that and the effect that it's going to have on, you know, sons and daughters of the church. Like, I think the damage is greater than we know. I'm sure you've seen the quote a number of times that I think about it a lot, of Richard Rohr saying, he has that great phrase about it, about how, about the sort of the consensus of white evangelical support for Trump being an indictment on the evangelical church for generations to come.
That's right.
I don't think that's an overstatement at all. And in terms of, like, combating it, you know, I have two thoughts that maybe compete just a little bit. On the one hand, I feel like the public witness of the church is worth contending for. And so that's part of the reason why I care. I mean, like, I know a lot of students and faculty at Liberty because just kind of the circles I run in, especially now as a writer and speaker. So I care, but I mean, I'm not an alumni or whatever, which I understand where somebody's like, so why are you involved? Like, you know, for me, part of it is that I feel like the witness of the church is worth contending for. And people do need to hear a counter narrative. People do need to hear from an alternative witness. I think that matters. But, you know, there's like this other side of me that's kind of like, and that's where I live in some tension right now. Like, I feel like it's, at least in my case, I feel like it's on me to do what I can to kind of speak out. But it's like, I don't know, you know, like, I'm honestly, I kind of feel like it's such a train wreck at this point. There's another part of me that says, like, you know, maybe some of it is worth letting go of. And, you know, I think a lot more about, I don't know what the new expressions are going to be. I can tell you that, like, without trying to go real charismatic on it, that in the last year of my life, the thing I keep coming back to is the story of the disciples on the road to Emmaus. And specifically, because I'd never seen this before actually reading this Easter of this year, this idea that, like, when the disciples go on this journey, that Jerusalem, which has been the sacred space for them, has been the holy place, has now been desecrated because Jesus has been killed there. And it just never hit me, you know, like, that they're walking from Jerusalem to Emmaus. They're walking away from the temple. They're walking away from the sacred space.
Right.
And in walking away from the sacred space, they have an encounter with the risen Jesus. But they don't know that that's the journey they're on. You know, they think they're just walking away. I mean, from, I think we kind of say from, like, divine perspective, they're walking into something quite wonderful. And, you know, that's kind of my more hopeful riff on this season is I want to believe, you know, that, like, while that maybe in some cases people actually do need to leave the institutional church in order to have an encounter with the resurrected Jesus. And then instead of it being all woe is me, I mean, part of what I love about that text in particular is that it's while these two disciples are having just a really authentic, vulnerable conversation about their despair that Jesus starts walking alongside them, and they don't, you know, they don't recognize them. So, like, this idea that even as they're walking away ostensibly from their community, a new community is coming up out of their pain in which God is present, you know? That's what I'm hopeful for. Because I mean, and in a weird way right now, like, with a lot of people, as much as I can keep in mind, I love the local church and feel like most of my life continues to be serving the local church in one form or another. And yet I feel like I see somebody who are disillusioned and feeling despair and walking away from certain sacred spaces, where I feel like the whole catalyst for that is they're trying to walk in integrity. You know, it's like it's a desire for God and integration and wholeness that makes them feel like they can't stay in those spaces.
Yeah, that's a really good answer. How big of an impact do you think that guys like Jerry Falwell and like Franklin Graham actually have now? Because there is kind of some competing theories about, like, well, they actually don't have a really big grip on kind of modern conservative evangelicalism. But I mean, Jerry Falwell's the president of a major Christian university. Franklin Graham is the son of one of the the most prominent evangelists in a generation. What are the roles that these guys have, and how much impact do you see them really having within conservative evangelicalism these days?
It's such a slippery question, because evangelical spirituality is slippery to begin with. When you don't have a magisterium, you don't have a pope, and questions of authority have always been a little bit open-ended. You know, what I think makes it really interesting right now, in my mind, I absolutely think that Jerry Falwell Jr. and Franklin Graham represent a form of evangelical Christianity that is rapidly dying. I mean, it's on life support. And I really think, like, the end of that as we've known it could come faster than we think, like on a broad scale. So on one hand, like, I definitely feel like those are voices that are in decline. The flip side of that, though, is when you try to reconcile that with, you know, the 81% of white evangelicals who did vote for Trump, and the fact that, you know, whether we like it or not, you know, I feel like Jerry Falwell Jr. and Franklin in particular are constantly still being cast as spokespersons, you know? So if that's the narrative the world's being told, if they're the ones who are constantly, you know, appearing on all the major networks as spokespeople, you know, that's part of the reason that I feel like it was important to engage at Liberty, because honestly, if it was the president of Bob Jones, and I don't mean that as a slur, but who cares? Liberty is the largest Christian institution for higher learning in North America, and the influence is so vast. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, as much as we may not like that, he does, in a way, speak for a pretty large swath of evangelicals. I think he's trying to, you know, and that, which is part of why I feel like that's a voice that's especially worth resisting. But back to your original question, I just feel like all that is being renegotiated right now. I feel like there are voices that still have a tremendous amount of influence in this moment, but I also think it's influence that is pretty rapidly waning. And without, again, trying to be ugly about it, I think for good reason. I mean, there's a reason those voices are waning.
Mm-hmm. So even though Jerry Falwell is a disaster, even though white conservative evangelicalism is playing a pretty significant part to the wrecking of so many both theological, church, and political norms, you touched on this a little bit earlier, but I want you to expand on it a little bit. What has you hopeful? We're going to end there. What has you hopeful right now?
The shortest way I know to put it would be students. You know, when I meet younger people, when I meet Christian college students, not just at Liberty, but at a lot of more conservative schools. Or just, you know, I spoke at an event at Taylor University a few months ago where I'd never been. I just couldn't believe. I mean, how advanced those students were in terms of even, like, you know, they're really wrestling with all the right questions about issues of race and racial reconciliation and all kinds of matters of justice and mercy and sexuality. You know, like, when in a weird way right now, I almost feel like it always makes me think of the biblical story of Noah when he gets drunk and naked and is exposed before his kids. Like, I feel like kind of my generation and older, that's where we are right now. We are exposed. And on one hand, I think that's awful. But there's another part of me that, like, I'm kind of glad that they're seeing it for what it is. I'm glad that they're seeing how just the level of delusion, because I think they do see it. I mean, they really do. And as much as I don't want, like, some kind of a generational culture war in the church, there's just no question, like, for Christians under 35, this is going nowhere, you know? So, like, when I'm around younger Christians, that's what makes me hopeful. I mean, of course, the tension I carry with that is that, you know, I think a lot about the verse in Malachi and the whole idea in the Old Testament of God turning the hearts of the fathers to the sons and mothers to daughters, and I do believe there's something intergenerational that God wants to do. So I don't want to kind of resign myself to a mentality of, well, you know, people just need to die off. But sometimes it can feel like that, you know,
sure.
Especially when people are clinging on as white knuckled as they are. Right. I mean, like 100% of my hope right now is in kind of the whatever comes out of the kind of 35 and under segment of the church. And that, okay. Which actually makes me feel tremendously hopeful.
That's awesome. Well, Jonathan, thank you so much for your time. I hope that you are enjoying your wonderful tour with Nicole Nordeman and Jen Hatmaker. So fun to see them out there crushing it.
Oh, yeah.
Just
they're
crushing
killing
it
right now. Tonight's been awesome. It's an amazing tour. Oh, and see, like, that makes me hopeful because even right there, honestly, but see, that's an interesting point, isn't it? Like, women, right?
Oh,
I mean, because
yeah.
What I'm seeing at these events over and over again, because I've been to a number of these shows, is that, and hey, praise God for, you know, Catholic and mainline women who are turning out and all that. But there are huge chunks of evangelicals who are coming to these events. And I feel like what I see even like in the kind of the audience that Jen and Nicole are reaching are these women inside of evangelical spaces who are tremendously open. And they're in the process of right now of exploring new ideas and their faith is expanding and it's becoming more roomy and spacious, you know. So that, you know, that makes me hopeful, too. But I do think it's significant that even there, I feel like that's happening more among women than it is among men, you know. So
ain't that
so it's
something?
Almost like I'm not trying to like, you know, I feel like this could almost sound like, you know, I'm not trying to just get in good with you or like or something, but it really does feel like sometimes like, yeah, but basically everything beyond the white men is pretty encouraging.
Yeah. That's awesome.
That really is how I see it.
I do too. I think that that's where the most vibrant life has always been in the church, right? Is in the places of the margins and
that's right.
With the communities that have been pushed out. So
totally.
I'm glad you see that too, buddy. So
yeah. There are reasons to be encouraged. And I am in a weird way. I am. Even the fact that like some of these things are getting the kind of traction they are right now, you know, it's like stuff is changing. Stuff is shifting. I think in this exact moment, I mean like part of what's, it's such a disaster right now. I know this much, evangelical spirituality as it has been cannot sustain at the place it is right now, you know? So that makes me hopeful too. Like there's no way it can stay where it is.
Okay. Well, I'm going to take that word.
Yes.
And we're going to hold
right?
on to it as a thing
Frederick
to be hopeful
Beaker talks
for.
About preaching as whistling in the dark to keep your own spirits up. That's what I'm doing right now.
I love it. Okay. Well, I will let you go. Thank you so much for taking
absolutely.
The time to
great
answer this quick question. Okay.
All right. Sounds good.
We're almost out of time, but before we go, we like to leave you every week with a recommendation or two, maybe a TV show, a movie, a podcast. Nish, what has caught your eye?
Well, two things. I'm going to cheat. I have two things. The first one is that I was so honored to be a guest on Sorta Awesome this week, which is a podcast that I love so much. Hosted by my dear friend Megan Teets. I was on her, it's like an extra awesome. So it's like an additional episode. And we talked about Stranger Things. So don't worry, Amy. I spent all of my words talking about Stranger Things.
I'm glad you got it out.
With Megan. And she kind of let me talk about our podcast over here a little bit. So I did do that. So I wanted to plug Megan and in that episode. If you're a Stranger Things fan, you can get all of my thoughts on Stranger Things over there. But the second thing is, ooh, Amy, one of my favorite music artists of all time is releasing an album in February, and her first single came out yesterday. Do you know Brandi Carlile?
From the 80s? Like
no,
Go-Go's?
That's Belinda Carlile.
Oh, my goodness. All right.
That would be Belinda. I'm talking about Brandi Carlile, singer-songwriter, and sounds like a more powerful and soulful Melissa Etheridge is kind of the way I describe her. She's got this beautiful, raspy, she's just this amazing, amazing artist. Anyway, she's one of my favorite singers. She has a new single out and it's called The Joke. And I literally spun into orbit listening to it. It's just so good. Her voice and her bandmates and the way they blend, and she's backed by a string quartet or like a string ensemble, and it is just a phenomenal song. I'll put a link in the show notes to it. There's a performance that she did that's on NPR, and it is unbelievable. Please go listen to it. Her voice is out of this world. So that is what I'm listening to. It has been on repeat since yesterday. And she's going on tour and the new album's coming out. And so I'm just really excited. I love new music. So I'm really thrilled about that. What about you? What have you been paying attention to?
Well, I'm going to pick two things because you picked two things.
Fine.
First is something we have been listening to in our car. I have to say, I am not really into kids' music, like music written for kids. I want to raise my kids with like good music taste. We listen to lots of Motown.
Yes.
And try to, you know, raise them right. There is a Ann Arbor-based group, and I grew up not very far from Ann Arbor, called the Kerfuffles. And when my kids are back in Michigan with my folks over the summer, they often go to like outdoor concerts, and the Kerfuffles were at one. And I have to say, there are some pretty catchy songs here. And I really love being able to sing along with our little 3-year-old son.
So cute.
He's totally into music.
He's so darling, too.
So
she's cute.
He is adorable. But now I'm completely blanking on the name of the song, but I think it is called I Ate Too Much Candy, which would also be a confession on my part. So check out the Kerfuffles. I enjoy them. The second thing, Nish.
Yes.
College basketball is back, baby.
Woo! Go Duke Blue Devils.
Oh.
Go.
Yes, listeners, this is where we are going to have problems, Nish and I, because
so good.
I am a graduate of the University of Michigan and a lifelong Michigan Wolverine fan. And Nish
is for
despite
the Blue
her
Devils.
Seeming intelligence and good taste.
It's just because you couldn't get into Duke.
Roots for the Blue Devils.
Just kidding.
Nish, we're not even going to start.
Coach K just got his 1,000th win.
So I am excited. We're not even going to talk about Coach K either because I have used up all my anger for this week. I don't have any more left. But college basketball brings me so much joy. It is hard for me to even find the words to communicate it. Some of the happiest times in my life have been watching college basketball games. I was the same year as the Fab Five at Michigan, for those of you who remember back to that era, and basically was just on cloud nine the entire time that I was there, except for a few pivotal losses, and we're also not going to go into those.
Well, good.
But basketball is back, and that makes me happy.
Well, that's all for this week's episode. Thanks for joining us. Impolite Company is produced every week by Constantine Hios. If you've enjoyed our conversation, please subscribe and visit us on Facebook at Impolite Company, the podcast. We'd love to hear from you and get your feedback, and we'll post links to our show notes as well. And until next week, have fun storming the castle, kids!